I'm playing a hunch, Terraza thought. But if Teg had gone to ground, the trail started on Gamble. The trail could have ended there as well. Yes. For Asmali to Gamble, Rakis must wait. There were certain obvious attractions in this move. It would not alert the guild. The Tlilazu and the ones from the scattering, however, would certainly rise to the bait. If Odraid failed to trap the Tlilazu... No, Odraid would not fail. That one had become almost a certainty. The unexpected. You see, Miles, I have learned from you. None of this deflected the opposition within the Sisterhood, though. Terraza put both palms flat on her table and pressed hard, as though trying to sense the people out there in Chapter House, the ones who shared Shuang Yu's opinions. Vocal opposition had subsided, but that always meant the violence was being readied. What shall I do? The Mother Superior was supposed to be immune to indecision in a crisis, but the Tlilazu connection had unbalanced their data. Some of the recommendations for Odraid appeared obvious and already had been transmitted. That much of the plan was plausible and simple. Take WAP into the desert far beyond unwanted eyes. Contrive a situation in extremis, and the consequent religious experience in the old and reliable pattern dictated by the Missionaria Protectiva. Test whether the Tlilazu were using the Gola process for their own kind of immortality. Odraid was perfectly capable of carrying out that much of the revised plan. It depended heavily on this young woman, Shiana, though. The worm itself is the unknown. Terraza reminded herself that today's worm was not the original worm of Rakis. Despite Shiana's demonstrated command over them, they were unpredictable. As archives would say, they had no track record. Terraza held little doubt that Odraid had made an accurate deduction about the Rakians and their dances. That was a plus. A language. But we do not yet speak it. That was a negative. I must make a decision tonight. Terraza sent her surface awareness roaming backward along that unbroken line of Mother Superior. All of those female memories encapsulated within the fragile awareness of herself and two others, Valanda and Asterion. It was a tortuous track through other memories, which she felt too tired to follow. Right at the edge of the track would be observations of Moabdib, the Atreides bastard who had shaken the universe twice, once by dominating the Imperium with his Fremen hordes, and then by spawning the Tyrant. If we are defeated this time, it could be the end of us, she thought. We could be swallowed whole by these hell-spawned females from the scattering. Alternatives presented themselves. The female child on Rakis could be passed into the Sisterhood's core to live out her life somewhere at the end of a no-ship's flight, an ignominious retreat. So much depended on Teg. Had he failed the Sisterhood at last? Or had he found an unexpected way to conceal the Gola? I must find a way to delay, Terraza thought. We must give Teg time to communicate with us. Odraid will have to drag out the plan on Rakis. It was dangerous, but it had to be done. Stiffly, Terraza lifted herself from her chair dog and went to the darkened window across from her. Chapter House planet lay in star-shadowed darkness. A refuge. Chapter House planet. Such planets were not even recipients of names anymore, only numbers somewhere in archives. This planet had seen 1,400 years of Bene Gesserit occupancy, but even that must be considered temporary. She thought of the Guardian no-ships orbiting overhead, Teg's own defense system in depth. Still, Chapter House remained vulnerable. The problem had a name. Accidental discovery. It was an eternal flaw. Out there in the scattering, humankind expanded exponentially, swarming across unlimited space. The Tyrant's golden path secure at last. Or was it? Surely the Atreides worm had planned more than the simple survival of the species. He did something to us that we have not yet unearthed, even after all of these millennia. I think I know what he did. My opposition says otherwise. It was never easy for a reverend mother to contemplate the bondage they had suffered under Leto II, as he whipped his imperium for 3,500 years along his golden path. We stumble when we review those times. Seeing her own reflection in the window's dark plaza, Taraza glared at herself. It was a grim face, and the fatigue easily visible. I have every right to be tired and grim. She knew that her training had channeled her deliberately into negative patterns. These were her defenses and her strengths. She remained distant in all human relationships, even in the seduction she had performed for the breeding mistresses. Taraza was the perpetual devil's advocate, and this had become a dominant force in the entire sisterhood, a natural consequence of her elevation to Mother Superior. Opposition developed easily in that environment. As the Sufi said, rot at the core always spreads outward. What they did not say was that some rots were noble and valuable. She reassured herself now with her more dependable data. The scattering took the tyrant's lessons outward in the human migrations, changed in unknown ways, but ultimately submissive to recognition. And in time, a way would be found to nullify a no-ship's invisibility. Taraza did not think the people of the scattering had found this, at least not the ones skulking back into the places that had spawned them. There was absolutely no safe course through the conflicting forces, but she thought the sisterhood had armed itself as well as it could. The problem was akin to that of a guild navigator threading his ship through the folds of space in a way that avoided collisions and entrapments. Entrapments, they were the key. And there was Odraid springing the sisterhood's traps on the Tlilazu. When Taraza thought about Odraid, which was often in these crisis times, their long association reasserted itself. It was as though she looked at a faded tapestry in which some figures remained bright. Brightest of all, assuring Odraid's position close to the seats of sisterhood command, was her capacity for cutting across details and getting at the surprising meat of a conflict. It was a form of that dangerous Atreides prescience working secretly within her. Using this hidden talent was the one thing that had aroused the most opposition, and it was the one argument that Taraza admitted had the most validity. That thing working far below the surface, its hidden movements indicated only by occasional turbulence, that was the problem. Use her, but stand ready to eliminate her, Taraza had argued. We will still have most of her offspring. Taraza knew she could depend on Lucilla, provided Lucilla had found sanctuary somewhere with Teg and the Gola. Alternate assassins existed at the keep on Rakis, of course. That weapon might have to be armed soon. Taraza experienced a sudden turmoil within herself. Other members advised caution in the utmost. Never again lose control of the breeding lines. Yes, if Odraid escaped an elimination attempt, she would be alienated forever. Odraid was a full Reverend Mother, and some of those must still remain out there in the scattering, not among the honored maters the sisterhood had observed. But still, never again, that was the operational motto. Never another Kwisatz Haderach or another tyrant. Control the breeders, control their offspring. Reverend mothers did not die when their flesh died. They sank farther and farther into the Bene Gesserit living core, until their casual instructions and even their unconscious observations became a part of the continuing sisterhood. Make no mistakes about Odraid. The response to Odraid required specific tailoring and exquisite care. Odraid, who allowed certain limited affections, a mild warmth she called them, argued that emotions provided valuable insights if you did not let them govern you. Terrazza saw this mild warmth as a way into the heart of Odraid, a vulnerable opening. I know what you think of me, Dar, with your mild warmth toward an old companion from school days. You think I am a potential danger to the Sisterhood, but that I can be saved from myself by watchful friends. Terrazza knew that some of her advisors shared Odraid's opinion, listened quietly, and reserved judgment. Most of them still followed the Mother Superior's lead, but many knew of Odraid's wild talent and had recognized Odraid's doubts. Only one thing kept most of the sisters in line, and Terrazza did not try to delude herself about it. Every Mother Superior acted out of a profound loyalty to her sisterhood. Nothing must endanger Bene Gesserit continuity, not even herself. In her precise and harshly self-judgmental way, Terrazza examined her relationship to the Sisterhood's continuing life. Obviously, there was no immediate necessity to eliminate Odraid. Yet Odraid was now so close to the center of the Gola design that little occurring there could escape her sensitive observation. Much that had not been revealed to her would become known. The Atreides Manifesto had been almost a gamble. Odraid, the obvious person to produce the manifesto, could only achieve a deeper insight as she wrote the document, but the words themselves were the ultimate barrier to revelation. Waff would appreciate that, Terrazza knew. Turning from the dark window, Terrazza went back to her chair dog. The moment of crucial decision, go or no go, could be delayed, but intermediate steps must be taken. She composed a sample message in her mind and examined it while sending a summons to Burzmali. The Bashar's favorite student would have to be sent into action, but not as Odraid wanted. The message to Odraid was essentially simple. Help is on the way. You are on the scene, Dar. Where safety of Girl Shiana is concerned, use own judgment. In all other matters that do not conflict with my orders, carry out the plan. There. That was it. Odraid had her instructions, the essentials that she would accept as the plan, even while she would recognize an incomplete pattern. Odraid would obey. The Dar was a nice touch, Terrazza thought. Dar and Tar. That opening into Odraid's limited warmth would not be well shielded from the Dar and Tar direction. The long table on the right is set for a banquet of roast desert hare in sauce sepida. The other dishes, clockwise to the right from the far end of the table, are aplomage Syrian, chuka under glass, coffee with melange, note the hawk crest of the Atreides on the urn, pata oi, and, in the balut crystal bottle, sparkling Caladan wine. Note the ancient poison detector concealed in the chandelier. Daris Balat, description at a museum display. Teg found Duncan in the tiny dining alcove off the No Globe's gleaming kitchen. Pausing in the passage to the alcove, Teg studied Duncan carefully. 8 days here, and the lad appeared finally to have recovered from the peculiar rage that had seized him as they entered the globe's access tube. They had come through a shallow cave musky with the odors of a native bear. The rocks at the back of the lar were not rocks, although they would have deceived even the most sophisticated examination. A slight protrusion in the rocks would shift if you knew or stumbled upon the secret code. That circular and twisting movement opened the entire rear wall of the cave. The access tube, brilliantly lighted automatically once they sealed the portal behind them, was decorated with Harkonnen griffins on walls and ceiling. Teg was struck by the image of a young Patrine stumbling into this place for the first time. The shock, the awe, the elation. And he failed to observe Duncan's reaction until a low growl swelled in the enclosed space. Duncan stood growling, almost a moan, fists clenched, gaze fixed on a Harkonnen griffin along the right-hand wall. Rage and confusion warred for supremacy on his face. He lifted both fists and crashed them against the raised figure, drawing blood from his hands. "Damn them to the deepest pits of hell!" he shouted. It was an oddly mature curse issuing from the youthful mouth. The instant the words were out, Duncan relapsed into uncontrolled shudders. Lucilla put an arm around him and stroked his neck in a soothing, almost sensual way, until the shuddering subsided. "Why did I do that?" Duncan whispered. "You will know when your original memories are restored," she said. "Harkonnens," Duncan whispered, and blood suffused his face. He looked up at Lucilla. "Why do I hate them so much?" "Words cannot explain it," she said. "You will have to wait for the memories."
"I don't want the memories."
Duncan shot a startled look at Teg.
"Yes, yes, I do want them."
Later, as he looked up at Teg in the No Globe's dining alcove, Duncan's memory obviously returned to that moment.
"When, Bashar?"
"Soon." Teg glanced around the area. Duncan sat alone at the auto-scrub table, a cup of brown liquid in front of him. Teg recognized the smell, one of the many melange-laced items from the Nullentropy bins. The bins were a treasure house of exotic foods, clothing, weapons, and other artifacts. A museum whose value could not be calculated. There was a thin layer of dust all through the globe, but no deterioration of the things stored here. Every bit of the food was laced with melange, not at an attic level, unless you were a glutton, but always noticeable. Even the preserved fruit had been dusted with the spice. The brown liquid in Duncan's cup was one of the things Lucilla had tasted and pronounced capable of sustaining life. Teg did not know precisely how Reverend Mothers did this, but his own mother had been capable of it. One taste, and they knew the contents of food or drink. A glance at the ornate clock set into the wall at the closed end of the alcove told Teg it was later than he thought, well into the third hour of their arbitrary afternoon. Duncan should still be up on the elaborate practice floor, but they both had seen Lucilla take off into the globe's upper reaches, and Teg saw this as a chance for them to talk unobserved. Pulling up a chair, Teg seated himself on the opposite side of the table. Duncan said, "I hate those clocks." "You hate everything here," Teg said. But he took a second look at the clock. It was another antique, a round face with two analog hands and a digital second counter. The two hands were Priapian, naked human figures, a large male with enormous phallus, and a smaller female with legs spread wide. Each time the two clock hands met, the male appeared to enter the female.
"Gross," Teg agreed.
He pointed to Duncan's drink. "You like that?"
"It's all right, sir. Lucilla says I should have it after exercise."
"My mother used to make me a similar drink for after heavy exertions," Teg said. He leaned forward and inhaled, remembering the aftertaste, the cloying melange in his nostrils.
"Sir, how long must we stay here?" Duncan asked.
"Until we are found by the right people, or until we're sure we will not be found."
"But cut off in here, how will we know?"
"When I judge it's time, I'll take the life shield blanket and start keeping watch outside."
"I hate this place."
"Obviously. But have you learned nothing about patience?" Duncan grimaced.
"Sir, why are you keeping me from being alone with Lucilla?"
Teg, exhaling as Duncan spoke, locked on the partial exhalation and then resumed breathing. He knew, though, that the lad had observed. If Duncan knew, then Lucilla must know.
"I don't think Lucilla knows what you're doing, sir," Duncan said, "but it's getting pretty obvious."
He glanced around him. "If this place didn't take so much of her attention, where does she dash off to like that?"
"I think she's up in the library."
"Library?"
I agree, it's primitive, but it's also fascinating. Tegg lifted his gaze to the scrollwork on the nearby kitchen ceiling. The moment of decision had arrived. Lucilla could not be depended upon to remain distracted much longer. Tegg shared her fascination, though. It was easy to lose yourself in these marvels. The whole no-globe complex, some 200 meters in diameter, was a fossil preserved intact from the time of the tyrant. When she spoke about it, Lucilla's voice took on a husky, whispering quality. Surely the tyrant must have known about this place. Tegg's mentat awareness had been immersed immediately in this suggestion. Why did the tyrant permit family Harkonnen to squander so much of their last remaining wealth on such an enterprise? Perhaps for that very reason, to drain them. The cost in bribes and guild shipping from the Ixion factories must have been astronomical. Did the tyrant know that one day we would need this place? Lucilla asked. No avoiding the prescient powers that Leto II had so often demonstrated, Tegg agreed. Looking at Duncan seated across from him, Tegg felt his neck hairs rising. There was something eerie about this Harkonnen hideaway, as though the tyrant himself might have been here. What had happened to the Harkonnens who built it? Tegg and Lucilla had found absolutely no clues to why the globe had been abandoned. Neither of them could wander through the no-globe without experiencing an acute sense of history. Tegg was constantly confounded by unanswered questions. Lucilla, too, commented on this. Where did they go? There's nothing in my other memories to give the slightest clue. Did the tyrant lure them out and kill them? I'm going back to the library. Perhaps today I'll find something. For the first 2 days of their occupation, the globe had received a careful examination by Lucilla and Tegg. A silent and sullen Duncan tagged along, as though he feared to be left alone. Each new discovery awed them or shocked them. 21 skeletons preserved in transparent plaths along a wall near the core. Macabre observers of everyone who passed through there to the machinery chambers and the nullentropy bins. Patrine had warned Tegg about the skeletons. On one of his first youthful examinations of the globe, Patrine had found records that said the dead ones were the artisans who had built the place, all slain by the Harkonnens to preserve the secret. Altogether, the globe was a remarkable achievement, an enclosure cut out of time, sealed away from everything external. After all of these millennia, its frictionless machinery still created a mimetic projection that even the most modern instruments could not distinguish from the background of dirt and rock. The Sisterhood must acquire this place intact, Lucilla kept saying. It's a treasure house. They even kept their family's breeding records. That wasn't all the Harkonnens had preserved here. Tegg kept finding himself repelled by subtle and gross touches on almost everything in the globe, like that clock, clothing, instruments for maintaining the environment, for education and pleasure. Everything had been marked by the Harkonnen compulsion to flaunt their uncaring sense of superiority to all other people and all other standards. Once more, Tegg thought of Patrine as a youth in this place, probably no older than the Gola. What had prompted Patrine to keep it a secret, even from his wife of so many years? Patrine had never touched on the reasons for secrecy, but Tegg made his own deductions. An unhappy childhood. The need for his own secret place. Friends who were not friends, but only people waiting to sneer at him. None of those companions could be permitted to share such a wonder. It was his. This was more than a place of lonely security. It had been Patrine's private token of victory. I spent many happy hours there, Bashar. Everything still works. The records are ancient, but excellent, once you grasp the dialect. There is much knowledge in the place, but you will understand when you get there. You will understand many things I have never told you. The antique practice floor showed signs of Patrine's frequent usage. He had changed the weapons coding on some of the automata in a way Tegg recognized. The time counters told of muscle-torturing hours at the complicated exercises. This globe explained those abilities which Tag had always found so remarkable in Patrine. Natural talents had been honed here. The automata of the no-globe were another matter. Most of them represented defiance of the ancient prescriptions against such devices. More than that, some had been designed for pleasure functions that confirmed the more revolting stories Tag had heard about the Harkonnens. Pain as pleasure. In its own way, these things explained the primly unbending morality that Patrine had taken away from Gamu. Revulsion created its own patterns. Duncan took a deep swallow of his drink and looked at Tag over the lip of the cup. "Why did you come down here alone, when I asked you to complete that last round of exercises?" Tag asked. "The exercises made no sense." Duncan put down his cup. "Well, Terraza, you were wrong," Tag thought. "He has struck out for complete independence sooner than you predicted." Also, Duncan had stopped addressing his Bashar as Sir. "You disobey me?"
"Not exactly."
"Then exactly what is it you're doing?"
"I have to know."
"You won't like me very much when you do know." Duncan looked startled.
"Sir?"
"Ah, the Sir is back. I have been preparing you for certain kinds of very intense pain," Tag said. "It is necessary before we can restore your original memories."
"Pain, sir?"
"We know of no other way to bring back the original Duncan Idaho, the one who died."
"Sir, if you can do that, I will be nothing but grateful."
"So you say. But you may very well see me then as just one more whip in the hands of those who have recalled you to life."
"Isn't it better to know, sir?"
Tag passed the back of a hand across his mouth. "If you hate me, can't say I'd blame you."
"Sir, if you were in my place, is that how you would feel?"
Duncan's posture, tone of voice, facial expression, all showed trembling confusion. So far, so good, Tag thought. The procedural steps were laid out with a precision that demanded that every response from the Gola be interpreted with care. Duncan was now filled with uncertainty. He wanted something, and he feared that thing. "I'm only your teacher, not your father," Tag said. Duncan recoiled at the harsh tone.
"Aren't you my friend?"
"That's a two-way street. The original Duncan Idaho will have to answer that for himself." A veiled look entered Duncan's eyes.
"Will I remember this place, the keep, Shuang Yu, and
everything? You'll undergo a kind of double vision memory for a time, but you'll remember it all." A cynical look came over the young face, and when he spoke, it was with bitterness.
"So you and I will become comrades."
All of Abashar's command and presence in his voice, Tag followed the reawakening instructions precisely. "I'm not particularly interested in becoming your comrade." He fixed a searching glare on Duncan's face. "You might make Bashar someday. I think it possible you have the right stuff. But I'll be long dead by then."
"You're only comrades with Bashar's?"
"Patrine was my comrade, and he never rose above squad leader." Duncan looked into his empty cup, and then at Tag.
"Why didn't you order something to drink? You worked hard up there, too."
Perceptive question. It did not do to underestimate this youth. He knew that food sharing was one of the most ancient rituals of association.
"The smell of yours was enough," Tag said. "Old memories. I don't need them right now."
"Then why did you come down here?" There it was, revealed in the young voice, hope and fear. He wanted Tag to say a particular thing.
"I wanted to take a careful measurement of how far those exercises have carried you," Tag said. "I needed to come down here and look at you."
"Why so careful?" Hope and fear. It was time for the precise shift of focus.
"I've never trained a Gola before."
Gola. The word lay suspended between them, hanging on the cooking smells that the globe's filters had not scrubbed from the air. Gola. It was laced with spice pungency from Duncan's empty cup. Duncan leaned forward without speaking, his expression eager. Lucilla's observation came into Teg's mind. He knows how to use silence. When it became obvious that Teg would not expand on that simple statement, Duncan sank back with a disappointed look. The left corner of his mouth turned downward, a sullen, festering expression. Everything focused inward the way it had to be.
"You did not come down here to be alone," Teg said. "You came here to hide. You're still hiding in here, and you think no one will ever find you."
Duncan put a hand in front of his mouth. It was a signal gesture for which Teg had been waiting. The instructions for this moment were clear. The Gola wants the original memories wakened and fears this utterly. That is the major barrier you must sunder.
"Take your hand away from your mouth," Teg ordered.
Duncan dropped his hand as though it had been burned. He stared at Teg like a trapped animal. "Speak the truth," Teg's instructions warned. "At this moment, every sense of fire, the Gola will see into your heart."
"I want you to know," Teg said, "that what the Sisterhood has ordered me to do to you, that this is distasteful to me."
Duncan appeared to crouch into himself.
"What did they order you to do?" "The skills I was ordered to give you are flawed."
"Flawed?" "Part of it was comprehensive training, the intellectual part. In that respect, you have been brought to the level of regimental commander."
"Better than Patrine?"
"Why must you be better than Patrine? Wasn't he your comrade?"
"Yes."
"You said he never rose above squad leader."
"Patrine was fully capable of taking over command of an entire multi-planet force. He was a tactical magician whose wisdom I employed on many occasions."
"But you said he never..."
"It was his choice.
The low rank gave him the common touch that we both found useful many times."
"Regimental commander?"
Duncan's voice was little more than a whisper. He stared at the tabletop. "You have an intellectual grasp of the functions. A bit impetuous, but experience usually smooths that out. Your weapon skills are superior for your age." Still not looking at Teg, Duncan asked,
"What is my age, sir?"
"Just as the instructions cautioned, the Gola will dance all around the central issue. What is my age? How old is a Gola?" His voice coldly accusing, Teg said, "If you want to know your Gola age, why don't you ask that?"
What is that age, sir?"
There was such a weight of misery in the youthful voice that Teg felt tears start in the corners of his eyes. He had been warned about this, too. Do not reveal too much compassion. Teg covered the moment by clearing his throat. He said,
"That's a question only you can answer."
The instructions were explicit. Turn it back on him. Keep him focused inward. Emotional pain is as important to this process as the physical pain. A deep sigh shuddered through Duncan. He closed his eyes tightly. When Teg had first seated himself at the table, Duncan had thought, "Is this the moment? Will he do it now?" But Teg's accusing tone, the verbal attacks were completely unexpected. And now Teg sounded patronizing. "He's patronizing me." Cynical anger surged into Duncan. Did Teg think him such a fool that he could be taken in by the most common ploy of a commander? Tone of voice and attitude alone can subjugate another's will. Duncan sensed something else in the patronizing, though. A core of plasteel that would not be penetrated. Integrity, purpose. And Duncan had seen the tear start, the covering gesture. Opening his eyes and looking directly at Teg, Duncan said, "I don't mean to be disrespectful or ungrateful or rude, sir, but I can't go on without answers." Teg's instructions were clear. "You will know when the Gola reaches the point of desperation. No Gola will try to hide this. It is intrinsic to their psyche. You will recognize it in voice and posture." Duncan had almost reached the critical point. Silence was mandatory for Teg now. Forced Duncan to ask his questions, to take his own course. Duncan said, "Did you know that I once thought of killing Shuangyu?" Teg opened his mouth and closed it without a sound. Silence. But the lad was serious. "I was afraid of her," Duncan said. "I don't like being afraid." He lowered his gaze. "You once told me that we only hate what's really dangerous to us." "He will approach it and retreat, approach and retreat. Wait until he plunges." "I don't hate you," Duncan said, looking once more at Teg. "I resented it when you said Gola to my face. But Lucilla's right. We should never resent the truth, even when it hurts." Teg rubbed his own lips. The desire to speak filled him, but it was not yet plunge time. "Doesn't it surprise you that I considered killing Shuangyu?" Duncan asked. Teg held himself rigid. Even the shaking of his head would be taken as a response. "I thought of slipping something into her drink," Duncan said. "But that's a coward's way, and I'm not a coward. Whatever else, I'm not that." Teg remained silently immobile. "I think you really care what happens to me, Bashar," Duncan said. "But you're right. We will never be comrades. If I survive, I will surpass you. Then it'll be too late for us to be comrades. You spoke the truth." Teg was unable to prevent himself from inhaling a deep breath of mentat realization. No avoiding the signs of strength in the Gola. Somewhere recently, perhaps in this very alcove just now, the youth had ceased being a youth and had become a man. The realization saddened Teg. It went so fast. No normal growing up in between. "Lucilla does not really care what happens to me the way you do," Duncan said. "She's just following her orders from that Mother Superior Terraza." "Not yet," Teg cautioned himself. He wet his lips with his tongue. "You have been obstructing Lucilla's orders," Duncan said. "What is it she's supposed to do to me?" The moment had come. "What do you think she's supposed to do?" Teg demanded. "I don't know." "The original Duncan Idaho would know." "You know? Why won't you tell me?" "I'm only supposed to help restore your original memories." "Then do it." "Only you can really do it." "I don't know how." Teg sat forward on the edge of his chair, but did not speak. Plunge point? He sensed something lacking in Duncan's desperation. "You know I can read lips, sir," Duncan said. "Once I went up to the Tower Observatory. I saw Lucilla and Shuangyu down below talking. Shuangyu said, 'Never mind that he's so young. You've had your orders.'" Once more, cautiously silent, Teg stared back at Duncan. It was like Duncan to move around secretly in the keep, spying, seeking knowledge. And he had seated himself in that memory mode now, not realizing that he still was spying and seeking, but in a different way. "I didn't think she was supposed to kill me," Duncan said. "But you know what she was supposed to do because you've been obstructing her." Duncan pounded a fist on the table. "Answer me, damn you!" Ah, full desperation. "I can only tell you that what she intends conflicts with my orders. I was commanded by Terraza herself to strengthen you and guard you from harm."
"But you said my training was flawed."
"Necessary. It was done to prepare you for your original memories."
"What am I supposed to do?" You already know. I don't, I tell you. Please teach me.
You do many things without having been taught them. Did we teach you disobedience?
Please help me.
It was a desperate wail. Tag forced himself to chilly remoteness. What in the nether hell do you think I'm doing? Duncan clenched both fists and pounded them on the table, making his cup dance. He glared at Tag. Abruptly, an odd expression came over Duncan's face, something grasping in his eyes.
Who are you? Duncan whispered.
The key question. Tag's voice was a lash striking out at a suddenly defenseless victim.
Who do you think I am?
A look of utter desperation twisted Duncan's features. He managed only a gasping stutter.
You're... Duncan, stop this nonsense!
Tag jumped to his feet and stared down with assumed rage.
You're...
Tag's right hand shot out in a swift arc. The open palm cracked against Duncan's cheek.
How dare you disobey me?
Left hand out, another rocking slap.
How dare you?
Duncan reacted so swiftly that Tag experienced an electric instant of absolute shock. Such speed. Although there were separate elements in Duncan's attack, it occurred in one fluid blur. A leap upward, both feet on the chair, rocking the chair, using that motion to slash the right arm down at Tag's vulnerable shoulder nerves. Responding out of trained instincts, Tag dodged sideways and flailed his left leg over the table into Duncan's groin. Tag still did not completely escape. The heel of Duncan's hand continued downward to strike beside the knee of Tag's flailing leg. It numbed the whole leg. Duncan sprawled across the tabletop, trying to slide backward in spite of the disabling kick. Tag supported himself, left hand on table, and chopped with the other hand to the base of Duncan's spine, into the nexus deliberately weakened by the exercises of the past few days. Duncan groaned as paralyzing agony shot through his body. Another person would have been immobilized, screaming, but Duncan merely groaned as he clawed toward Tag, continuing the attack. Relentless in the necessities of the moment, Tag proceeded to create greater pain in his victim, making sure each time that Duncan saw the attacker's face at the instant of greatest agony. Watch his eyes, the instructions warned. And Belanda, reinforcing the procedure, had cautioned, his eyes will seem to look through you, but he will call you Leto. Much later, Tag found difficulty in recalling each detail of his obedience to the reawakening procedure. He knew that he continued to function as commanded, but his memory went elsewhere, leaving the flesh free to carry out his orders. Oddly, his trick memory fastened onto another act of disobedience, the Serbol Revolt, himself at middle age but already a Bashar with a formidable reputation. He had donned his best uniform without its medals, a subtle touch that, and had presented himself in the scorching noon heat of Serbol's battle-plowed fields, completely unarmed in the path of the advancing rebels. Many among the attackers owed him their lives. Most of them had once given him their deepest allegiance. Now they were in violent disobedience. And Tag's presence in their path said to those advancing soldiers, I will not wear the medals that tell what I did for you when we were comrades. I will not be anything that says I am one of you. I wear only the uniform that announces that I am still the Bashar. Kill me, if that is how far you will carry your disobedience. When most of the attacking force threw down their arms and came forward, some of their commanders bent the knee to their old Bashar, and he remonstrated, You never needed to bow to me, or get on your knees. Your new leaders have taught you bad habits. Later he told the rebels he shared some of their grievances. Serbol had been badly misused,
But he also warned them, "One of the most dangerous things in the universe is an ignorant people with real grievances. That is nowhere near as dangerous, however, as an informed and intelligent society with grievances. The damage that vengeful intelligence can wreak, you cannot even imagine. The tyrant would seem a benevolent father figure by comparison with what you are about to create." It was all true, of course, but in a Bene Gesserit context. And it helped little with what he was commanded to do to the Duncan, Idaho Gola, creating mental and physical agony in an almost helpless victim. Easiest to recall was the look in Duncan's eyes. They did not change focus, but glared directly up into Teg's face, even at the instant of the final screaming shout. "Damn you, Leto! What are you doing?" "He called me Leto." Teg limped backward 2 steps. His left leg tingled and ached where Duncan had struck it. Teg realized that he was panting and at the end of his reserves. He was much too old for such exertions, and the things he had just done made him feel dirty. The reawakening procedure was thoroughly fixed in his awareness, though. He knew that Golas once had been awakened by conditioning them unconsciously to attempt murder on someone they loved. The Gola psyche, shattered and forced to reassemble, was always psychologically scarred. This new technique left the scars in the one who managed the process. Slowly, moving against the outcry of muscles and nerves that had been stunned by agony, Duncan slid backward off the table and stood leaning against his chair, trembling and glaring at Teg. Teg's instruction said, "You must stand very quietly. Do not move. Let him look at you as he will." Teg stood unmoving as he had been instructed. Memory of the Serbo revolt left his mind. He knew what he had done then and now. In a way, the 2 times were similar. He had told the rebels no ultimate truths, if such existed. Only enough to lure them back into the fold. Pain and its predictable consequences. This is for your own good. Was it really good what they did to this Duncan, Idaho Gola? Teg wondered what was occurring in Duncan's consciousness. Teg had been told as much as was known about these moments, but he could see that the words were inadequate. Duncan's eyes and face gave abundant evidence of internal turmoil, a hideous twisting of mouth and cheeks, the gaze darting this way and that. Slowly, exquisite in its slowness, Duncan's face relaxed. His body continued to tremble. He felt the throbbing of his body as a distant thing, aches and darting pains that had happened to someone else. He was here, though, in this immediate moment, whatever and wherever this was. His memories would not mesh. He felt suddenly out of place in flesh too young, not fitted to his pre-Gola existence. The darting and twisting of awareness was all internal now. Teg's instructors had said, "He will have Gola-imposed filters on his pre-Gola memories. Some of the original memories will come flooding back. Other recollections will return more slowly. There will be no meshing, though, until he recalls that original moment of death." Valanda had then given Teg the known details of that fatal moment. "Sardaukar," Duncan whispered. He looked around him at the Harkonnen symbols that permeated the Noglobe. The Emperor's crack troops wearing Harkonnen uniforms. A wolfish grin twisted his mouth. How they must have hated that. Teg remained silently watchful. "They killed me," Duncan said. It was a flatly unemotional statement, all the more chilling for its positive delivery. A violent shudder passed through him, and the trembling subsided. "At least 12 of them in that little room." He looked directly at Teg. "One of them got through at me like a meat cleaver right down on my head." He hesitated,
his throat working convulsively. His gaze remained on Teg. Did I buy Paul enough time to escape? Answer all of his questions truthfully. He escaped. Now they came to a testing moment. Where had the Tlilazu acquired the Idaho cells? The Sisterhood's tests said they were original, but suspicions remained. The Tlilax had done something of their own to the Skola. His memories could be a valuable clue to that thing. But the Harkonnens, Duncan said. His memories from the keep meshed. Oh, yes. Oh, yes! A fierce laugh shook him. He sent a roaring victory shout at the long-dead Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. I paid you back, Baron. Oh, I did it to you for all of the ones you destroyed. You remember the keep and the things we taught you? Teg asked. A puzzled frown drew deep crease lines across Duncan's forehead. Emotional pain warred with his physical pains. He nodded in response to Teg's question. There were two lives, one that had been walled off behind the Xlotl tanks, and another... Duncan felt incomplete. Something remained suppressed within him. The reawakening was not finished. He stared angrily at Teg. Was there more? Teg had been brutal. Necessary brutality? Was this how you had to restore Angola? Duncan shook his head from side to side like a great wounded animal in front of the hunter. Do you have all of your memories? Teg insisted. All? Oh, yes. I remember Gamu, when it was Gaia D Prime. The oil-soaked, blood-soaked hellhole of the Imperium. Yes, indeed, Bashar. I was your dutiful student. Regimental commander. Again he laughed, throwing his head back in an oddly adult gesture for that young body. Teg experienced the sudden release of a deep satisfaction, far deeper than relief. It had worked as they said it would. Do you hate me? He asked. Hate you? Didn't I tell you I would be grateful? Abruptly, Duncan lifted his hands and peered at them. He shifted his gaze downward at his youthful body. What a temptation, he muttered. He dropped his hands and focused on Teg's face, tracing the lines of identity. Atreides, he said. You're all so damned alike. Not at all, Teg said. I'm not talking about appearance, Bashar. His eyes went out of focus. I asked my age. There was a long silence then. Gods of the deep, so much time has passed. Teg said what he had been instructed to say. The Sisterhood has need of you. In this immature body, what am I supposed to do? Truly, I don't know, Duncan. The body will mature, and I presume a Reverend Mother will explain matters to you. Lucilla? Abruptly, Duncan looked up at the ornate ceiling, then at the alcove and its Baroque clock. He remembered coming here with Teg and Lucilla. This place was the same, but it was different. Harkonnens, he whispered. He sent a glowering look at Teg. Do you know how many of my family the Harkonnens tortured and killed? One of Taraza's archivists gave me a report. A report? You think words can tell it? No. But that was the only answer I had to your question. Damn you, Bashar! Why do you Atreides always have to be so truthful and honorable? I think it's bred into us. That's quite right. The voice was Lucilla's and came from behind Teg. Teg did not turn. How much had she heard? How long had she been there? Lucilla came up to stand beside Teg, but her attention was on Duncan. I see that you've done it, Miles. Taraza's orders to the letter, Teg said. You have been very clever, Miles, she said.
much more clever than I suspected you could be. That mother of yours should have been severely punished for what she taught you.
Ah, Lucilla the seductress, Duncan said. He glanced at Teg and returned his attention to Lucilla.
Yes, now I can answer my other question. What she's supposed to do.
They're called imprinters, Teg said.
Miles, Lucilla said,
if you have complicated my task in ways that prevent me from carrying out my orders, I will have you roasted on a skewer.
The emotionless quality of her voice sent a shudder through Teg. He knew her threat was a metaphor, but the implications in the threat were real.
A punishment banquet, Duncan said. How nice.
Teg addressed himself to Duncan.
There's nothing romantic about what we've done to you, Duncan. I've assisted the Bene Gesserit in more than one assignment that left me feeling dirty, but never dirtier than this one.
Silence!
Lucilla ordered. The full force of voice was in the command. Teg let it flow through him and past him, as his mother had taught. Then,
those of us who give our true loyalty to the sisterhood have only one concern, survival of the Bene Gesserit. Not survival of any individual, but of the sisterhood itself. Deceptions, dishonesties, those are empty words when the question is the sisterhood's survival.
Damn that mother of yours, Miles,
Lucilla paid him the compliment of not hiding her rage. Duncan stared at Lucilla. Who was she? Lucilla. He felt his memories stirring of themselves. Lucilla was not the same person. Not the same at all, and yet bits and pieces were the same. Her voice, her features. Abruptly, he saw again the face of the woman he had glimpsed on the wall of his room at the keep.
Duncan. My sweet Duncan.
Tears fell from Duncan's eyes. His own mother, another Harkonnen victim, tortured. Who knew what else? Never seen again by her sweet Duncan.
Gods, I wish I had one of them to kill right now, Duncan moaned.
Once more he focused on Lucilla. Tears blurred her features and made the comparisons easier. Lucilla's face blended with that of the Lady Jessica, beloved of Leto Atreides. Duncan glanced at Teg, back to Lucilla, shaking the tears from his eyes as he moved. The memory faces dissolved into that of the real Lucilla standing in front of him. Similarities, but never the same. Never again the same. Imprinter. He could guess the meaning. A pure Duncan Idaho wildness arose in him.
Is it my child you want in your womb, imprinter? I know you're not called mothers for nothing.
Her voice cold, Lucilla said,
we'll discuss it another time.
Let us discuss it in a congenial place, Duncan said. Perhaps I'll sing you a song. Not as good as old Gurney Halleck would do it, but good enough to prepare for a little bed sport.
You find this amusing? She asked.
Amusing?
No, but I am reminded of Gurney.
Tell me, Bashar, have you brought him back from the dead, too?
Not to my knowledge, Teg said.
Ah, there was a singing man, Duncan said. He could be killing you while he sang and never miss a note. Her manner still icy, Lucilla said,
we of the Bene Gesserit have learned to avoid music. It evokes too many confusing emotions. Memory emotions, of course.
It was meant to awe him with a reminder of all those other memories and the Bene Gesserit powers these implied, but Duncan only laughed louder.
What a shame that is, he said. You miss so much of life.
And he began humming an old Halleck refrain.
Review, friends,
troops long past review. But his mind whirled elsewhere with the rich new flavor of these reborn moments, and once more he felt the eager touch of something powerful that remained buried within him. Whatever it was violent, and it concerned Lucilla, the imprinter. In imagination, he saw her dead, and her body awash in blood. People always want something more than immediate joy, or that deeper sense called happiness. This is one of the secrets by which we shape the fulfillment of our designs. The something more assumes amplified power with people who cannot give it a name, or who, most often the case, do not even suspect its existence. Most people only react unconsciously to such hidden forces. Thus, we have only to call a calculated something more into existence, define it, and give it shape. Then people will follow. Leadership Secrets of the Bene Gesserit. With a silent waff about 20 paces ahead of them, Odrade and Shiana walked down a weed-fringed road beside a spice storage yard. All of them wore new desert robes and glistening stillsuits. The gray Nullplas fence that defined the yard beside them held bits of grass and cottony seed pods in its meshes. Looking at the seed pods, Odrade thought of them as life trying to break through a human intervention. Behind them, the blocky buildings that had arisen around Daris Balat baked in the sunlight of early afternoon. Hot, dry air burned her throat when she inhaled too quickly. Odrade felt dizzy and at war within herself. Thirst nagged at her. She walked as though balanced on the edge of a precipice. The situation she had created at Taraz's command might explode momentarily. How fragile it is. Three forces balanced, not really supporting each other, but joined by motives that could shift in an instant and topple the whole alliance. The military people sent by Taraza did not reassure Odrade. Where was Teg? Where was Burzmali? For that matter, where was the Gola? He should be here by now. Why had she been ordered to delay matters? Today's venture would certainly delay matters. Although it had Taraza's blessing, Odrade thought this excursion into the Desert of the Worms might be a permanent delay. And there was Wav. If he survived, would there be any pieces for him to pick up? Despite the healing applications of the Sisterhood's best quick-knit amplifiers, Wav said his arms still ached where Odrade had broken them. He was not complaining, merely providing information. He appeared to accept their fragile alliance, even the modifications that incorporated the Rakian priestly cabal. No doubt he was reassured that one of his own face dancers occupied the high priest's bench in the guise of Tuek. Waff spoke forcefully when he demanded his breeding mothers from the Bene Gesserit, and consequently withheld his part of their bargain. Only a small delay while the Sisterhood reviews the new agreement, Odrade explained. Meanwhile, today was meanwhile. Odrade put aside her misgivings and began to enter the mood of this venture. Waff's behavior fascinated her, especially his reaction on meeting Shiana. Quite plainly fearful, and more than a little in awe. The minion of his prophet. Odrade glanced sideways at the girl walking dutifully beside her. There was the real leverage for shaping these events into the Bene Gesserit design. The Sisterhood's breakthrough into the reality behind Lilazu behavior excited Odrade. Waff's fanatic, true faith gained shape with each new response from him. She felt fortunate just to be here studying a Tlilazu master in a religious setting. The very grit under Waff's feet ignited behavior that she had been trained to identify. We should have guessed, Odrade thought. The manipulations of our own Missionaria Protectiva should have told us how the Tlilazu did it, keeping themselves to themselves, blocking off every intrusion for all of those plotting millennia. They did not appear to have copied the Bene Gesserit structure. And what other force could do such a thing? It was a religion, the great belief. Unless the Tlilazu are using their Gola system as a kind of immortality. Terraza could be right. Reincarnated Tlilazu masters would not be like Reverend Mothers. No other memories, only personal memories, but prolonged. Fascinating. Odrade looked ahead at Wap's back. Plotting. It appeared to come naturally to him. She recalled that he called Shiana Alyama. Another confirming linguistic insight into Waf's great belief. It meant blessed one. The Tlilazu had kept an ancient language not only alive, but unchanged. Did Waf not know that only powerful forces such as religions did that? We have the roots of your obsession in our grasp, Waf. It is not unlike some that we have created. We know how to manipulate such things for our own purposes. Terraza's communication burned in Odrade's awareness. The Tlilazu plan is transparent. Ascendancy. The human universe must be made into a Tlilazu universe. They could not hope to achieve such a goal without help from the scattering. Ergo. The Mother Superior's reasoning could not be denied. Even the opposition within that deep schism that threatened to shatter the sisterhood agreed. But the thought of those human masses in the scattering, their numbers exploding exponentially, produced a lonely sense of desperation in Odrade. We are so few compared to them. Shiana stooped and picked up a pebble. She looked at it a moment, and then threw it at the fence beside them. The pebble sailed through the meshes without touching them. Odrade took a firmer grip on herself. The sounds of their footsteps on the blown sand that drifted across this little-used roadway seemed suddenly over-loud. The spindly causeway leading out over the Dar es Balat Ring Kanat and Moat lay no more than 200 paces ahead at the end of this narrow road. Shiana spoke. I am doing this because you ordered it, Mother, but I still don't know why. Because this is the crucible where we test Waf and through him reshape the Tlilazu. It is a demonstration, Odrade said. That was true. It was not the whole truth, but it served. Shiana walked head down, gaze intent on where she placed each step. Was this how she always approached her Shaitan? Odrade wondered, thoughtful and remote. Odrade heard a faint thwacking sound high up behind her. The watchful ornithopters were arriving. They would keep their distance, but many eyes would observe this demonstration. I will dance, Shiana said. That usually calls a big one. Odrade felt her heartbeat quicken. Would the big one continue to obey Shiana, despite the presence of two companions? This is suicidal madness. But it had to be done. Terraza's orders. Odrade glanced at the fenced spice yard beside them. The place appeared oddly familiar, more than deja vu. Inner certainty informed by other memories told her this place remained virtually unchanged from ancient times. The design of the spice silos in the yard was as old as Rakis. Oval tanks on tall legs, metal and plaz insects waiting stilt-legged to leap upon their prey. She suspected an unconscious message from the original designers. Melange is both boon and bane. Beneath the silos, a sandy wasteland where no growth was permitted spread out beside mud-walled buildings. An amoeba arm of Dar es Balat reaching almost to the Kanat edge. the tyrant's long-hidden no-globe had produced a teeming religious community that hid most of its activities behind windowless walls and underground. The secret working of our unconscious desires. Once more, Shiana spoke. Tuek is different. Odrate saw Waf's head lift sharply. He had heard. He would be thinking, can we conceal things from the prophet's messenger? Too many people already knew that a face dancer masqueraded as Tuek, Odrate thought. The priestly Kabul, of course, believed they were giving the Tlilazu enough netting in which to snare not only the Bene Tlilax, but the sisterhood as well. Odrade smelled the biting odors of chemicals that had been used to kill wild growth in the spice storage yard. The odors forced her attention back to necessities. She did not dare indulge in mental wanderings out here. It would be so easy for the sisterhood to become caught in its own trap. Shiana stumbled and emitted a small cry, more irritation than pain. Wap turned his head sharply and looked at Shiana before returning his attention to the roadway. The child had merely stumbled on a break in the road surface, he saw. Drifted sand concealed places where the roadway had been cracked. The fairy structure of the causeway ahead of him appeared sound, however, not substantial enough to support one of the prophet's descendants, but more than enough for a supplicant human to cross it into the desert.